Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. It's Thursday, June the 21st. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. We are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany.
Coming up, Cameroon's government says the Anglophone crisis has claimed more than 80 government soldiers and police. But what about civilian casualties?
What the Prime Minister actually said is that there were more than 100 civilians who were killed in this conflict, and he said they were killed by separatists. He didn't mention that the soldiers actually also killed civilians.
And there's a raging debate on the use of the CFA franc in Francophone Africa.
If people understand what the French CFA was, and then it was created for the former French colonies, when you have a currency which you cannot control by yourself, it cannot really help you in terms of moving forward economically.
Well, we will get to hear about that raging debate. These are some of the stories that we have lined up for you. Plus, of course, your views of them and other stories on our page DW Africa on Facebook. But before all that, let's get to hear what has been making headlines around the world.
I'm Eunice Wanjiro with DW News. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is visiting Jordan amid an escalating domestic conflict over migration that has shaken her coalition government. In talks between Merkel and Jordan's King Abdullah, refugee policy topped the agenda. Hundreds of thousands of displaced Syrians, including some initially hosted by Jordan, have migrated onward to Europe with Germany as a key destination. Merkel made no reference to the political crisis back home that could bring about the collapse of her coalition.
We know that we face the same challenges, which means the challenge of fighting Daesh, Islamic State. It also means that we need to pursue a peace process in Syria. And I want to highlight once again what Jordan is doing in view of hosting this enormous number of refugees.
Beherbergung von Flüchtlingen.
The Chancellor said Germany will provide a loan of $100 million, in addition to bilateral aid, which amounts to about $443 million this year. Merkel's visit to Jordan is part of a two-day trip that will also take her to Lebanon, two of the countries most severely affected by the ongoing refugee crisis. Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has met with leaders of the four Visegrad countries, that's Hungary, Poland, Slovakia and the Czech Republic, to discuss immigration and EU budget issues. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán said the Visegrad Four group and Austria agreed to beef up the EU's external border defence and process migrants outside the EU's borders. Kurz is the only one of the five leaders who will attend a mini-summit on the migration crisis in Brussels this weekend. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. In the US, House and Senate Democrats are demanding that President Donald Trump reunite the families that were separated at the US border. Trump on Wednesday issued an executive order that allowed families to stay together, but the Democrats say that the Health and Human Services Department didn't take immediate steps to reunite the families.
We're signing an executive order I consider to be a very important executive order. It's about keeping families together while at the same time being sure that we have a very powerful, very strong border, and border security will be equal, if not greater, than previously.
The House is set to vote on Thursday on two immigration bills. Moving on, South Sudanese rebels said on Thursday that more time is needed to secure lasting peace in the country and that it would be necessary to address the root cause of a civil war. There is no shortcut to peace, the group said in a statement after peace talks in Ethiopia with the government. And in World Cup action on Thursday, Mile Jedinak's penalty and Australia a 1-1 draw with Denmark in an entertaining Group C match. At halftime, France leads against Peru 1-0 and Argentina takes on Croatia later tonight. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Eunice Wanjiro.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link program. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. A warm welcome to you joining us live on our Facebook, DW Africa. Write to us, feel free to leave us a comment and, of course, share this audio. We begin the program in Cameroon, where armed separatists in the English-speaking regions have killed over 80 soldiers. That's according to a government report. No figures are available for casualties on the separatist side.
Violence in Cameroon's northwest and southwest regions flared up in late 2016 after the minority English-speaking people demanded greater representation. So what do the latest casualty figures tell us about the intensity of this crisis? I put that question to DW's correspondent Ngala Killian Chimpton in Yaoundé.
Well, I think what that really basically means is that the conflict has been really, really intense. It also means that the separatists have really also been quite forceful in their attacks, meaning that if they can kill up to 84 soldiers, because that's what the prime minister said, means that they've really also been well-equipped, you know, really having some weapons nobody would have suspected they would have. And therefore, it's a very, very serious issue, I should say. Nobody expected this to happen, knowing that Cameroon has always touted itself as a country of peace and security. And when you have 84 soldiers killed within a space of, I think, about 2 years today, it's a really big concern.
Now, there are no actual figures for the number of separatists and civilians that have been killed in this conflict. Is that a deliberate thing from the government side, or is it just too difficult to get these numbers?
Well, what the Prime Minister actually said is that there were more than 100 civilians who were killed in this conflict, and he said they were killed by separatists. He didn't mention that the soldiers actually also killed civilians, which is what this report is being contested by, especially the separatists who are saying that the Prime Minister's report is one-sided. They say the soldiers have also killed quite a number of people, and which is actually lacking in this report. So I would say that there is a deliberate attempt by the government, you know, to shield part of the information that should have been made known to the public.
All right. Now, this conflict is fast approaching, as you mentioned, almost 2 years since it began with the protests in Bamenda. How realistic is it that a ceasefire or a solution could come anytime soon?
That's a hard one to answer. Honestly, the separatists, they've said, well, we can only negotiate on the grounds of knowing how the English speakers can break away from the country. They've been saying that they want to break away and form a country called Ambazonia. The government says they cannot negotiate with separatists. So this is a very, very hard nut to crack. The church, for example, has offered to come in as negotiators, as peacemakers, as people who can bring the two warring sides together. But it's a very, very fine line to walk, because when you have two extremist positions, the government saying they cannot dialogue with the people they call terrorists, and then the separatists themselves saying that they can only negotiate on the basis of the government granting them their independence, it becomes a very, very difficult route to walk.
DW correspondent Ngala Killian Chimpton in Yaoundé.
And we did ask on our Facebook page, can President Paul Biya restore peace in the country? And most of you have divided opinions. Lorenzo Priest says police and soldiers have also killed civilians and burnt down their houses, and some flee to go hide in the forest.
And Al Afu says France has the biggest hand in any country that speaks French. Check all French colonies in Africa. They are fighting wars. Of course, we'll come to those comments whenever we have the time. But now let's move to the international stage. And Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel today visited Jordan, a major refugee's host country, in the wake of the growing domestic dispute over her handling of the migration situation in Germany that has shaken her coalition government. Merkel held talks with King Abdullah, where refugees' policy was top on the agenda. Hundreds of thousands of refugees, including some earlier hosted by Jordan, have migrated to Germany. DW's chief political correspondent Michaela Kufner tells us more.
In Jordan, German Chancellor Angela Merkel pledged an additional $100 million in credit for Jordan, which already receives some $384 million in support and development aid. It's a country that is severely under pressure from the issue of migration and that at the same time needs to make sure its own population has a good future. Those were the words of the German Chancellor here, recognizing what Jordan is contributing to keeping this region stable. And stability is also what Jordanian King Abdullah said was a common interest, where both countries were working for each other's interests here.
Merkel's visit comes as Germany's manufacturing industry, trade unions and opposition leaders united in their criticism of her coalition government 100 days after it was sworn in. Here's EW's chief political correspondent Michaela Kufner again.
Of course, the overarching issue for the German Chancellor is the political crisis that is brewing back home. And that is all about migration, her initial open arms policy. She's severely under pressure. Her chief foreign policy advisor stayed behind in Berlin to get more and more EU countries to pledge that they will join the special informal summit on migration this coming Sunday, which in the end will show how great Angela Merkel's personal support as a politician is in Europe. After all, she promised to deliver bilateral deals in time for the upcoming EU summit in under 10 days' time.
DW's chief political correspondent, Michaela Kufner.
And now we go back to Africa, this time to West Africa, where the French-backed CFA franc currency is facing growing opposition in parts of West and Central Africa. A group of musicians from West Africa have just released a song titled 7 Minutes Against the CFA.
The CFA franc was created by France in the late 1940s to serve as a legal tender in its then African colonies, and it is one of the most prominent signs of France's continued influence over its former colonies.
I have been speaking to my colleague Sonia Pontier to find out why the song 7 Minutes Against the CFA is controversial.
The song is really basically talking about that we don't want the franc CFA anymore, because if people understand what the franc CFA was, it was created in 1945, as we know, and then it was created for the former French colonies. And when those countries gained independence, some of them, let's say 40, some of them, 12 among them, still continue using that currency. But when you have a currency which you cannot control by yourself, it cannot really help you in terms of moving forward economically.
Yeah, and that is exactly the bone of contention, because they say that the countries have to deposit in the foreign reserves at the French treasury. And the question is, why haven't they left, or why can they not leave?
Most of those African leaders who are still part of the France CFA group, if I may say, they believe that if they leave the France CFA, their economy will scramble, because they believe that African countries don't have strong economy, and then for that they need a stability towards the euro, which is what the France CFA give them. And you, as maybe somebody from Ivory Coast or somebody from Mali, when you are going maybe overseas and then you want to exchange, that money, that currency you are having, holding in your hands, is not recognized by anybody. So which is now making a problem, which you are by, when you have your money, you have to exchange towards the euro. When you exchange towards the euro, that's when you can now use for buying whatever. And that's what country does. But when they do that, they take the money, and now when they want to reconvert into franc CFA to use for their country, they have to leave that 50% in the French Central Bank.
And in one part of the song, this Togolese rapper Elom says, "I think that the CFA currency represents a currency for monkeys." He says, "We are still seen as monkeys, as animals. It's not a currency that represents our economies." Do you think this is the feeling among many young Cameroonians like you?
Some Cameroonians, coming from my perspective, from where I come from, a lot of Cameroonians also are supporting the fact that we need to get out of that system in which we have found ourselves in, a system that we did not even decide for ourselves. Some young people are also willing to take that risk in order to move forward.
I was talking to my colleague Sonia Pontier, a journalist from Cameroon.
And now back to our main story, that's the crisis in Anglophone region in Cameroon. On our page, we have comments from Roosevelt Ndoum, who says peace will only come when the two countries go their own way. The UN must organize a referendum for the Anglophone to make their choice.
Prosperity J, also listening to us live on Facebook, says we need to put an end to the 57 years unholy concubine relationship with French Cameroon. Time to go our separate ways.
A very, very strong comment there. And Peter Efiani says, let them go and stop killing innocent people because they are asking for freedom.
Yeah, and of course we also have many more, like Victor Michael says, Paul Biya is a problem in Cameroon. Before he came to power, there was peace in the country.
And Prosperity J says negotiations on separation is the only way forward for peace to reign. Thank you so much for those comments. Keep them coming on our DW Africa page.
You are listening to DW's Africa Link. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, young South Africans lament the high cost of internet data connection.
It hurts me because my thing is, if Vodacom is South African, why is it cheaper in another country? That's unacceptable.
Being the IT guy, I now have to check whether connectivity is actually better so that I can manage my data usage, you know? It's insane.
Let's hope you have enough data to stay with us for the rest of the show, because we have some interesting stories lined up. European countries are trying to cut down on diesel emissions, and some cities are implementing driving bans or are boosting public transport to rid cities of heavy car polluters.
But these polluters don't simply just disappear. Sometimes old second-hand cars, which are often the worst polluters, don't end up on the scrap heap here, but are exported to Africa instead. Ina Kemules with this report by Linda Staude.
A seemingly endless convoy of cars sits banked up, bumper to bumper. This 8-lane highway is completely blocked, and the drivers are losing patience.
This traffic jam is terrible. You think it is working? We have been up from 5, we have been doing a lot.
Now it's 8 o'clock, and rush hour in Nairobi city centre is far from over. Heat radiates from the tarmac, and the air is thick with fumes.
It's not rocket science to see that there is a big air quality problem here. If you go here in Nairobi in the early morning to one of the higher buildings, you can see a blanket of pollution hanging over the city.
That's Rob de Jong, head of air quality and mobility at the United Nations Environment Programme. He says there's limited reliable data telling us just how bad the air quality really is in Nairobi.
There has been some research done that shows that the air pollution in cities like Nairobi and Lagos and other big African cities is pretty bad. It's not as bad as the Delhis and the Beijings, which are among the worst, but it's definitely having major health impacts.
The main reason for that, apart from open cooking fires and the few factory stacks, are exhaust fumes. But the desire for mobility means the number of cars in Nairobi is doubling every 8 years, only making the city's traffic and pollution problems worse. Further south in the port city of Mombasa, huge container ships from around the world are unloading cargo destined for the whole of East Africa. Among their loads, there are plenty of cars, shipped from Europe and Japan, almost all of them second-hand. Legal regulations and financial incentives are just a few ways authorities could encourage car enthusiasts to opt for low-emission models. Steve Mwale says that protecting the environment is gradually becoming more important to Kenyans.
When it comes to emission and all that, pollution is part of the fact that can bring country down or something. Because you realize, like, when we are facing a little bit of a droughtness, some of the places, because of this pollution of the environment, which is part of it.
Environmental protection laws are rare in Africa. In most countries, there are simply no regulations to limit the importation of used cars, which are heavy polluters. Uganda, for example, has long resisted taking such a step because the country has made huge profits from importing old used cars. In neighbouring Kenya, though, some changes are already being implemented, such as a maximum age limit for imported used cars. Jane Akumu is also with the UN Environment Programme.
The main challenge is inspection and maintenance. A lot of people don't do oil changes, you know, the regular maintenance, so the pollution levels are quite high.
That's why the UN Environment Programme and Rob de Jong are calling for uniform rules for the whole continent.
This is a very sensitive issue in Africa. If we go to African countries and say, you should stop importing old vehicles, they say, so basically, we're not allowed to motorise. You've motorised in Europe, you've motorised in Japan.
Rob de Jong says exporters also have to take responsibility and play a part in making sure that unwanted polluting cars from Europe don't end up in Africa.
That report was written by Linda Staude.
Right, and Bayer Jeremiah says governments within the sub-regions should invest more in public transport, and it should also be affordable.
Georgia Chimbi says only vehicles that have passed the emission test should be imported.
That's also very tricky compared you know, if you compare to what is happening in Germany with the diesel scandal. Anyway, that's another matter altogether. God's Praise or Rock says we need an effective urban transport system so that people will have the option of leaving their cars at home. We also need good car hiring systems. We in Nigeria are a long way from achieving this.
And Sunny Azike is asking us, Crispin, maybe we should answer, why do you people like asking questions in every matter? Can't you come up with solutions?
Well, we do ask so that we can have a dialogue. We can talk about these issues and come up with solutions on the web. And hopefully, you know, policymakers would also pick them up.
Precisely.
I think that's why we initiate these questions.
Yes.
I hope I've answered you, Sunny Azike. Anyway, keep those comments coming on DW Africa page. We can read them whenever we have the time.
Use on.
Now, for many young people in Africa, staying connected via the internet has become so crucial that some compare it to a basic need, such as food. Despite the growing number of internet users across the continent, nearly 500 million people are connected to the web, the cost for data connection remains relatively high.
Like in South Africa, where the high cost of data led to protests under the hashtag Data Must Fall. As Stephen Moore found out in this report presented by Sela Oneko, the big telecom companies are under pressure to lower the costs.
€1 is roughly what you pay for 1 gigabyte of internet data in Egypt. In South Africa, the two largest mobile operators, MTN and Vodacom, are charging 10 times more. The result? Almost half of South Africa's population are too poor to afford regular internet access. Especially the youth are not happy with the situation.
It is too expensive. And considering, you know, in other places in Africa where it's like
cheap.
That's what hurts me.
Yeah.
It hurts me because my thing is, if Vodacom is South African, why is it cheaper in another country? And yet we're getting the wrath. Are we paying other people's bills? Is that what actually happening? Because now that's really freaking me out. That's unacceptable.
Being the IT guy, I now have to check whether connectivity is actually better so that I can manage my data usage, you know? It's insane.
Social media campaigns like Data Must Fall are now drawing attention to the high prices local operators charge. At Johannesburg's Metro FM, radio host Bonginkosi Dlamini, aka DJ Zola, has invited students into the show to discuss the issue.
You guys have been hearing about this noise Data Must Fall, right?
Smaller data bundles cost much more than bigger bundles, which wealthier people can buy. This means young people and poor households are hit the hardest. Carefully considering every megabyte, poor students are losing out on important learning opportunities, says nursing student Mpo Mofokeng.
When I compare to other children who had access to internet, they performed much better than I.
These are varsity students. We need them to graduate. So if they find a hurdle where they cannot now study because of things like bundles, it becomes unfair to them. And maybe bundles in Africa should be taken pretty much in data as a basic human right need. Maybe should be associated somewhere with water and bread and a meal.
For the activists of the Right to Know movement, access to knowledge and opportunities should be a basic human right. For years, they've been trying to negotiate better terms of access to the internet, says Cleopatra Shezi, who is a member.
Data is not a luxury. We have a right to communicate. But at the moment, I don't see that happening because those who afford to buy themselves data, know who are privileged to have internet in their offices or workplace or at home, they are the ones who are communicating freely. What about the poor of the poorest? What about the working class who are unemployed? That is the big question.
Data has become the door opener to a better life. For many young people in South Africa, however, this door remains firmly shut by the network operators. An official inquiry has recently been launched investigating whether the big players are fixing the prices behind the scenes.
That report was compiled by Stephen Moore.
And Zipporah, we still have comments coming in on our live stream on Facebook. One from Umar Ahmad Abubakar, who says, I'm listening from Gombe, Nigeria. And of course, so many comments on the story about the Anglophone crisis that has now claimed more than 80 government soldiers and police.
Jerome Koto is asking, why is there always a problem? Africans, we need to move forward.
And Chimezie Naemeka of Orbuike says, not only Cameroon, we Biafra, we need a referendum. So it's not only the Amazonians who should have a referendum, but also the Biafrans are now calling for one.
Yeah, so those are your comments. Keep giving us your feedback because we love hearing from you.
Speaking out.
It's been a year since the controversial non-governmental organization or NGO law came into effect in Uganda. Since then, the country's civil society, especially NGOs, are at crossroads with the government as their operational space continues to shrink through restriction and control.
As our DW correspondent in Uganda, Michael Wambi, found out, there is a growing concern that the new restrictive laws are hampering many people from freely expressing themselves and exercising their human rights.
NGOs in Uganda have in the past worked with the government offering humanitarian services in formerly war-torn northern Uganda. Many have also been active in offering health services in HIV/AIDS prevention. With relative peace in the country and falling HIV prevalence, the NGOs have had to shift their focus. They are more vocal in faulting the government. The Ugandan government has responded by ensuring enactment of the new restrictive NGO law and regulation that came into effect last year. Onesmus Mujenyi from the Advocates Coalition for Development and Environment says the fact that NGOs have to sign memorandums of understanding with local governments before being allowed to operate is already a stumbling block.
You can imagine if it is a civil society that is working at a district level and it is raising, for example, non-transparent, non-accountability manner in which a local government is operating. And then you are saying that actually an NGO to operate in a district must have an MOU with that district. Would you expect that actually the district authorities will be able to execute that MOU? Certainly not.
Uganda's new law is the latest in the Horn of Africa. The concern is that the new law, just like those in its neighborhoods, is so restrictive for NGOs seeking registration. Margaret Sekaja is a human rights defender in Uganda who now sits on the NGO Registration Bureau, says the NGO law should be revisited.
The law has come out to be very strict. Now the law says you must register, you must get a permit. If you are going to work with a local government, you need to get an MOU. Therefore, these informal sectors, eventually, if they need to do certain things, they will need to get a permit. So the law itself became strict, requires people to register to get permits, and that's how it's gone. Unless we get a revision.
NGOs receiving external funding are perceived as agents of external powers who want to undermine the government. But the civil society, on the other hand, accuses the authority of maintaining power without any form of accountability. Richard Sewachirianga is the executive director of the National NGO Forum in Uganda.
We are in a difficult position. I think that difficult space that we are in a sense, it is inevitable for us to engage with the state because the state is present and also absent to all of us. It is present when you don't need it. If you stood outside there and said you want to remove age limits, you'll have 100 patrols coming. If you fell down there and you broke your leg, there would be no ambulance. So the state will be present, the state will be absent.
That is Richard Sewakrunga, Executive Director of the National NGOs Uganda, speaking in that report compiled by Michael Wambi.
Now, in another development, police say 15 people were injured when two female suicide bombers targeted the edge of a military barracks in northeast Nigeria. This comes just days after 9 soldiers were killed in a Boko Haram attack north of Maiduguri. Also on Saturday, suicide bombers killed 43 people in Damboa, southwest of Maiduguri, which has raised fresh questions about security for internally displaced peoples in the remote region. So we asked you on Facebook, what do you think? Is Boko Haram on the verge of being defeated?
Yeah, and many people are skeptical of the government, like Mugumia Omukakamu, who says Buhari has totally failed to step Boko militants. UN should come up.
And Amy also says UN is useless, handicapped and double-faced. Good move by Trump for stepping aside.
Mike Jughead, that's a funny name, says the ones telling you Boko Haram is on the verge of defeat are the ones sponsoring them. We are tired of this, Nigeria.
And Prince Young says Buhari of Nigeria and Paul Biya of Cameroon are the key sponsors of this Boko Haram. Very strong allegation and accusation from Prince Young. Thank you very much for all those comments and for listening. I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. Bye for now.